Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 348. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about rhinos, ululation, and Ernest Hemingway as we go to Uganda. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into this week's interview, first, a word of thanks for all of you who voted for the Amateur Traveler in the podcast awards. The voting is over, and now we just wait for the results. You may remember in Boston, there was a story of a stowaway who tried to sneak aboard a plane through the wheel well and then very tragically fell to his death. Well, his parents are suing the airport. The lawsuit says the airport should have been more careful and should have prevented him from getting access to the tarmac. One wonders if someone, not to name any names, should have taught him to make better decisions. Speaking of making bad decisions, let's talk about Ryanair. They're getting some flack because they have a policy, obviously, against people carrying on too many items, but they have apparently kicked people off because in addition to their carry-on, they were also carrying a jacket or a sweater. I understand that's against the rules, but I think that's also a little ridiculous. Speaking of ridiculous, a man in South Africa who was trying to smuggle diamonds was arrested after he swallowed 220 diamonds. I understand that that's only barely a travel story, but how often do you get to use the phrase, passing stolen goods, with such clarity? For links to all three of those stories, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome to the show Christian Cummins, who's coming to us from FM4 or FM FIA radio in Austria. Christian, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
And then you're come to talk to us about Uganda, and you had a bit of an unusual trip to Uganda.
Well, I did. I've just come back from cycling across Uganda because I was raising some money for a children's educational charity. But it was also a wonderful opportunity just to go to this country, which I'd never been to East Africa before. And it was a great way to see a country you see in the news for always negative reasons, and then to go and discover it for how it really is, as a tourist at least.
And I definitely want to get more into that, but I do want to give you the opportunity to tell us a little more about the charity that you were cycling for.
Okay, it's called Link Community Development, and what it's trying to do is improve schools almost on a organizational level. So they work with local communities, with the local authorities, and give these sort of informal assessments at how well a school is doing, what could be done to improve it. They don't build schools, they don't provide teachers. It's more on a looking at the goals, looking at how to improve education there, and trying to implement a few kind of model schools, hoping that the government says, wow, the schools that they're involved in, they're really working, the class sizes are getting smaller, less kids are dropping out, the kids are staying healthier. Let's see what's going on in these schools and see if we can make that part of our national educational policy. So it's a sort of, they're trying to make role model schools, but particularly what's important, it's local people visiting these schools, working with the community and trying to get as many people involved in believing in the education as possible. Because quickly, in Uganda, they was the first country to introduce universal primary education. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was very hard once you got more and more kids in schools to keep the schools to the standard that they need to be to accommodate all these new influx of kids.
Right. No, I've seen places like we mentioned in last week's show that my visits to Tanzania, talking to teachers there who have, again, they have universal education, but you might still have a classroom with 100 kids and two books. So that does present some challenges.
What's astounding is that there's no easy solution, of course, because mm-hmm. What amazed me about Uganda is that I think 50% of the population are under the age of 15. Mm-hmm. So there are just lots and lots of kids. And even if every university graduate decided to go into primary education, there would still be a lot of kids from school teachers. At one of the schools I visited, which was actually a very good school, there were 800 kids and 15 teachers. It's an amazing challenge.
Interesting. So now, I'm not sure that we will duplicate your trip. I'm not sure that there are many of us who are going to be an English, grow up in England, be on the radio in Austria, and then go cycle in Uganda. But if we were to do that, where would you start us in Uganda?
It was, I don't want to sound too worthy here, because it was in aid of raising money for a very good charity, and we did visit schools. But I have to say, when I was in Uganda, I had a wonderful time and did a lot of touristy things, went to some of the most well-known towns, and went to some national parks. We went to the Ziwa Rhino Sanctuary. I saw some rhino for the first time. We went up to the Murchison Falls National Park, which fans of Hemingway will know as the area where he had two plane crashes in a week. We even stayed in the Hemingway Hotel. And most of the places I went, you could easily get to if you go and visit Uganda. And I think most of them I'd recommend, actually. As I said, I've never been there. And I was just blown away by the natural beauty of the country, but particularly the friendliness of the people. It was awe-inspiring.
Now, had you been to Africa before?
Yeah, I worked as a volunteer journalist in Ghana about 10 years ago. And I was there for about 6 months and then traveled up to Burkina Faso and Mali. And I fell deeply in love with Africa. You can fall in love with a diverse continent, but I hadn't been back since for various reasons. So it was also wonderful for me to go back. You get more scared as you get older, you know, and I started worrying about things. And within a few hours of arriving in Uganda, I was in the town of Jinja then, on the banks of Lake Victoria, and it was smells that aren't that pleasant, actually. The kind of the mix of kerosene and charcoal and the dust that made me think, wow, I'm back. And then within 2 hours of being in Uganda, we were testing out our bikes, cycling past this compound, and there were some women ululating. And we thought, oh, I wonder what's going on in here.
And I'm not sure that everyone got the immediate sound in my head that I got when you said that. Can you describe what you meant by they were ululating?
And you know when they get a... this sound that African women and women actually from many places make to signify joy. Mm-hmm. And of course, that kind of draws you to find out what's going on. And we went up to this compound and we were waved in, and there was a wedding going on. And we were there in our kind of sweaty, skin-tight lycra and were immediately invited into this wedding. We were shaking hands with the bride's family. We were meeting the groom. People threw confetti over our heads. We were embarrassing ourselves on the dance floor and giving little kids rides around on our big bikes in the compound and treated basically like special guests at a stranger's wedding. And I thought, only in Africa would people be that spontaneous and that welcoming that they invite a bunch of people off the streets and make them guests at their wedding. And I thought, wow, that's why I loved it in the first place.
Excellent. And you mentioned a couple different places that you went. Why don't we slow down and do those? You started down by Kampala, I gathered?
Yes. We arrived in Kampala and Entebbe Airports, the airport in Uganda. Famous, of course, for that hijacking drama back in the 70s.
And for those of you who were too young to remember, you just have to rent the movie Raid on Entebbe.
Yeah. It was when Idi Amin let the Palestinian PLA.
It was PLO, I think. Was it? Or PLO, PLA?
Yeah. We should know.
It was one of those two, but you're right.
When a Palestinian organization hijacked a German plane and Idi Amin let them land in Entebbe Airport in Uganda. And then there was a very daring commando raid, I think, from the Israelis, which you can still see in an abandoned part of the airport, the bullet holes in the wall. And apparently, this is what the guidebook tells me, actually, if you ask people working at the airport, they'll show you around that now ghost wing, which they don't use anymore. Anyway, that's where you arrive. But we went straight through Kampala into the town of Jinja, which is the historic source of the Nile. It's where it emerges from Lake Victoria and where the European explorers were very excited to say, this is where this great river, 6,000 kilometers, 4,000 miles long, starts before it ends in the Mediterranean. And it's a nice town there.
What led you to Jinja?
Yeah, Jinja, it's quite a wealthy town. Because, well, there are wealthy parts of town because a lot of the urban elite from Kampala go and buy second homes there because it's a beautiful location overlooking Lake Victoria. And as I say, just where this river emerges out of the lake. So it's quite a historical place to go. And they have these big marabou stalks. I'm not sure if you know what I'm talking about, but they're about this child. And they've got these long wattles like streaky bacon that hang down. They're incredibly ugly on the ground, and then they fly and they look like, you know, massive eagles. They're fascinating animals, and they're always digging about in the rubbish. They're almost like the recyclers of Uganda. They're always wandering around, and then immediately you see these cows with very, very long horns lounging around by the side of the road, and you can get off the plane and know you're in Africa straight away. There's no disguising it. You do not get things like that in any other continents, as far as I've worked out.
And where else did you go then after Jinja?
From Jinja, we headed up north through some farming towns that probably, this is where maybe tourists wouldn't go, but perhaps should. The first one was, a lot of the settlements are a bit like frontier Wild West towns in the United States, you know, as you imagine them at least, because they're just one big street with wooden houses on each side. And they've got that certain vibe because a lot of the open shop fronts are blaring swing music out of them. But I guess they're not the sort of places to linger apart from just to enjoy the vibrancy of the market. But on the second day, we went up through the rural plantation area of Uganda to a town called Luero. And everywhere along there is where the sweet pineapples, where the mangoes, where the coffee, which is a great product of Uganda, is grown. And you go through these plantations and people are really excited to see you. The children run to the side of the road. They shout, "Mzungu, Mzungu," which means white man, white man. I guess you feel a bit like a circus act, but it's done without any ill feeling. It's all excitement at seeing someone who looks so palpably different, particularly when you're wearing lycra. And there's this wonderful feeling of excitement when you go through there. And not just the children. Everyone who we passed wanted a little joke with us, a little bit of banter. I was there on my multi-geared mountain bike with my lycra and these pedals you clip in. And often young people on their big bikes, on their big Chinese clunkers, would challenge me to bike races through the village and be waiting And by the way, at first I thought, aha, I'll let them win because it's funny. And then I thought, no, I'm going to show this guy. And I never could catch them up. And there was always this wonderful sense of fun that people were prepared to have a little bit of fun with you as an outsider. There were broad grins. And this is what I really appreciated because, as I said at the beginning, Uganda is the country I knew through news reports. Even this year, we had this Kony 2012 film that made viral on the internet. It was all about Uganda. Critics said a little bit outdated now, but there have been huge problems in the north. Of course, you all know it from the horrors of Idi Amin. Everyone who's seen the film or read the book Last King of Scotland knows Uganda like that. And of course, these things are all true. These things all happened and it's awful. We were going through Luero, and the Luero Triangle is where the current president, Yoweri Museveni, started his Bush war that eventually took him to power. At that time, hundreds of thousands of civilians were killed by Obote's, his rivals' marauding troops. And it's a place of horror. And you can't imagine it now, 30 years on. It was a place of smiles and welcoming. And of course, as a tourist, you don't see below the surface. But it's a Uganda, I guess, as Uganda would like to be seen, a place. It was very fertile. It was friendly. It was safe. And just this wonderful vibrancy of the people, if I keep repeating myself. Those are the places perhaps off the tourist map. But the next day we went up to somewhere where I think everyone who goes to Uganda probably will go. We went to the Murchison Falls National Park. Mm-hmm. It's a place where the Nile is squeezed through some sheer rock sidewalls, so it becomes fiery and watery. And the park itself is full of wildlife. We saw hippos and elephants. There are also giraffe. We saw giraffe by the side of the road, water buffalo, and the Nile flows through this park. One thing I have to warn tourists about, anyone visiting Uganda, the tsetse flies. We had to cycle through this park. There's the forested area before you get to the savanna area where the big game is. And there, I've never seen so many flies. We were warned that there were going to be many, but also that they don't carry sleeping sickness, which is many tsetse flies do. These ones don't. So we got bitten, but we weren't so worried.
And how do they know? I mean, you mentioned that now that you get older, more you have more fears than you used to have when you were in Africa. But obviously, the two biggest fears, I think we'd have to say, would be disease and that things are not always as stable as one might think. Even in countries like Kenya, just to the east of there, we thought of it as one of the most stable countries until, what, 2-3 years ago, right?
That's it. The same as the Ivory Coast, which when West Africa was the model place to go because it was known as kind of Paris of West Africa, and now things do change. Yeah, I think it is a concern, and people who do go to Uganda are warned not to go to the northeast of the country.
Near the Congo?
No, actually, we were near the border of Congo, where there used to be cross-border raids, and they've really quietened down. There hasn't been any we were for.
Oh, okay.
The Murchison Falls National Park is almost on the border with Congo. You can see Congo from there, which for me was really interesting for me because Congo is one of these places that is so wrapped up in negative headlines that you almost believe it doesn't exist. It just exists on the screens of CNN and BBC. and there it was palpably in the distance, which was almost quite enticing to go there.
Well, it's both a country that is not currently on my list of places to go and where a good friend just went. Moved there to work with an NGO. So
okay, yeah, well, a fascinating place, of course, but I didn't go there. But what's the guide of the boat we took on the Nile up there near Lake Albert, which is basically the border lake between Congo and Uganda, told me was that for many, many years there were so many weapons in the area and there were people coming over the border that it was impossible to protect the wildlife. Even the security people couldn't do anything, and they were mercilessly hunted, and there was a worry this great national park would fall victim to the instability in Uganda because basically the animals were being killed. And it's been stable for at least a decade now, and things are really looking up there. You just saw how many animals there were. We saw so many hippos. Milton said to me, the guide, he said, if you don't want to see hippos, you should not be here. Which, because I'm quite scared of hippos, I have to say. And just the bird life, elephants washing themselves near the river, baboons in the trees. Apparently, they're terrified of water, and yet they live in trees that hang over the water. These fantastic giraffes, who, when I look at them, I just feel calm. There's something about giraffes that can transmit this feeling of serenity.
Well, and of course, in that area, a giraffe or two giraffes with entwined necks are a symbol of peace.
Is that right?
On the other hand, a giraffe can kick a full-grown lion to death if it threatens. So,
yeah, I imagine that. And what amazes me about giraffes is also when they run, how funny they look, and yet they can reach amazing speeds. Yeah, giraffes are fascinating. So despite the instability of the past, this area is really recovering. And I don't want to sound like someone from the Ugandan tourist board, but I guess people are like me. They have certain images in their mind when you hear about countries and you think, Lord's Resistance Army can't go to Uganda. The LRA are mostly now in DR Congo, in South Sudan, sadly for these countries, Central African Republic, not so much in Uganda. So it is considered by most authorities to be a safe country to travel. And at no point did we feel in any way threatened, unwelcome. Perhaps we went to visit one school project on the banks of Lake Albert, and you could see it was just a poorer area, and the the new oil has been discovered in Uganda, and there were oil men around there. And for the first time, there was a mix between the curiosity and the bit of hostility I felt. People were slightly less sure why we were there. And instead of running up and screaming, the kids kind of looked at us in quite a world-weary way. And for the first time, people asked us for money. That was just actually in that area, just west of the park. And it was interesting to see because it was a different attitude from the rest of the country. So I guess Uganda has different pockets depending on its level of development. And one theory we had was it was perhaps also the controversial issue of oil coming and suddenly rich men in big 4x4 speeding through the villages that had changed their attitude to visitors. But that's a theory. I'm not sure if that's true. But that was near Bulisa, just on the edge of the Murchison Falls National Park, which was a wonderful place to go.
How much time did you spend in country total?
Not long at all. I was only there for 10 days. It seemed, I'll tell you, Chris, when you're cycling through a country, it's so intensive that we were saying this to each other at the end, that we'd been there for months and we'd known each other for our entire lives. It was a short visit. One place I have to really recommend, I skipped myself. I was so excited to tell you about Murchison Falls National Park, that we also went to a rhino sanctuary, which particularly for American listeners would be really interesting because they have a few rhino. They have 16, I think. This is off the top of my head. But some of them come from Disney World in Florida and have been reintroduced into the wild.
Oh, really? Okay.
Rhino used to be all quite prevalent in Uganda. Mm-hmm. And they almost died out. And now they've got this sanctuary below the town of Masindi, so below the Murchison Falls National Park. And when we were there, we were the only visitors. So you go and see rhino on your own. And we met a baby rhino. And his mum came from the United States, from Disney World. And his dad had been brought from a national park in Kenya. So, of course, what did they call the baby? Obama. and you get really close to the rhino there. We had a guide called Opeo who was fantastic. And he was telling us, the rhino charge, you should climb a tree.
If he does charge, what you need to do is you climb up a tree or you get in one of these big bushes.
Hide behind the bush and he won't see me because I'm no good at climbing trees.
Better you hide behind the bush.
And I haven't climbed a tree in a long time, and I was not very good at it at the time, so I'm not sure how well I'd do in a panic. So I said, hey, this doesn't happen very often, does it? And he said, this week, two or three times, the rangers had to climb a tree. The rangers following the rhino at a distance all day. There's a night shift and a day shift because they're very worried about poachers. Mm-hmm. They know it's happened in other places, so they're just very, very careful about it.
Because of the value of the rhino horn on the black market, I assume.
Yeah, on the Chinese market, often things are sold always to make you more potent, isn't it? It seems crazy. So they're very, very careful to look after them. And rhinos like this kind of wetland area, and it rained. When it rains in Uganda, Chris, it rains and it rains and it rains. Unbelievable downpours. So we went the day after a downpour, and you have these wellies and you have to wade through this boggy, marshy grassland area studded with acacia trees. But you come very, very close to the rhino. For me, that was perhaps the highlight because I never thought I'd ever do that. And I never thought when they said you could see them, we'd get that close. And of course, to be not in some safari car and packed out, but to just be walking through this area was great. If I had my eye on the nearest tree the entire time. Yeah.
What surprised you about Uganda? You know, you hadn't been to this country before.
Well, a few things that might seem superficial to you, but I'm from England where there's a Premier League football league, and this was an absolute obsession in Uganda. I haven't seen any matches all season because I live in Austria, but in Uganda you can miss them. Every time you go into a guest house, it's on telly and people have gathered to watch it. If you go through Kampala, when you see long queues on a Saturday, it's because they're queuing outside betting shops showing the Premier League football. And I'm a Manchester United fan. In England, that's very frowned upon because they're kind of a big and loads of fellow fans. So that was great. I was really surprised, I guess, by what you can do with bananas. Apparently, Ugandans eat per head 250 to 300 kilograms of bananas per year. And you think of bananas just one thing, but they have lots of different varieties. Every little homestead has maybe two banana trees just for their own consumption. Even in town, houses have banana trees outside.
So they're cooking with bananas too. They're not just eating them fresh.
No, you can eat them fresh, and they come in these very small varieties, a very small, about the size of your thumb.
Oh, barely. Like an apple banana.
Yeah, is that what they called it? Oh, I think they called it Mvezi, which is my acoustic hearing of how they were described. You also get the long green bananas that are cooked inside banana leaves in a pot into a sort of porridgey, thick goo. And matuke, and they're so popular, it's also just the word for food, and that was served with everything, and it was really good, particularly if you put peanut sauce over it. But it is really, really heavy, and my friend Alex, who'd worked in schools in the area, said it's hard because the kids eat this at lunchtime and then they fall asleep because it's just that sort of heavy food that makes you fall asleep. But you can't persuade Ugandans not to have it all the time. They love it. And to be honest, when you only have it for a week, you can see why. I think for my taste, if I had it every day, it might be a bit heavy. But I love their obsession with bananas because I'd say to them, wow, you love bananas. And they'd say, yeah, we do. And there's no kind of, yeah, of course we do. It was a real kind of palpable interest in bananas. There was a blight in the trees a year ago, and people were apparently almost panicking because if the banana failed in Uganda, it would be a totally different country. It's the country of bananas.
Interesting. What do you wish you had known before you went to Uganda?
Since I've got back, I've been reading a lot more about the history because it's always interesting to know before you go, and you buy loads of books, don't you? But you never find time to read them until you've been. And then it all seems more real, and it's a fascinating history. Also, the history of Europeans in Uganda. It was a protectorate, not a colony. And just when people first arrived, there's a guy called Speke who arrived, a Scottish explorer. And he arrived at the end of the 19th century and was totally in awe, actually, of the king of Buganda at that time. And how quickly that went from this admiration to subjugating the people. And, of course, then there was the history of colonialism and then a very difficult history afterwards. I found it, A, very, very interesting, and too good to understand the country now, and the problems of tribalism and the factions and the places we went through that I described to you as idyllic just a few years ago in my living memory were anything but idyllic. And it's important to know history, isn't it? And it's important to know what went wrong because you wish countries like this all the well in the world. And I wish I'd known more when I went there. Well, I'm a journalist, so I want to ask people things the whole time. So I'd have loved to have known more about how Uganda got to where it is today. What else would I have known? I would have known, well, they eat grasshoppers there, and they're apparently delicious. They call it Sundaesi.
You see, they're apparently delicious. There was a key phrase in there.
I'd say that, shouldn't I? Yeah. They're said delicious, and I've never eaten them, and I want to because every time anyone says, oh, insects are disgusting, I think, well, surely lobster are disgusting to look at, and shrimps are disgusting to look at, and yet we love them, and I'm determined to eat insects. And I guess this is one of the places where it would be really part of the culture.
It's funny how we have our cultural ideas that way. When I was in Costa Rica earlier this year, we saw some black and orange things on the road, and we kept, in fact, running over them in the dark. And I thought they were tarantulas because we had seen tarantulas with the same coloring and just was terribly creeped out. And then we discovered later on they were crabs, still the same size, but somehow a very small crab versus a very large tarantula has a very different reaction for me. I mean, they're both in the same family. They're it's just different. We have our preset approaches to things.
I guess a lobster is, or a shrimp is, a watery locust, but we don't see it that way. We see them as delicate. That's apparently, as I say, I'm talking big about these things I didn't eat, but this is why I wanted to eat them, because apparently they are kind of the shrimps of the land.
I've had crickets. I haven't had grasshoppers, and they were okay. So I wouldn't say that they were my favorite meal, but...
One more thing. I briefly mentioned it. I was really delighted to stay in the Hemingway Hotel. It's not called the Hemingway Hotel, but the hotel in Masindi, where he stayed.
in between plane crashes here?
Recovering from two plane crashes in there. One was exactly where we were in the Murchison Falls National Park. He's a pilot of a little plane he chartered, was flying them really low so they could get great photos of the waterfalls there, which are spectacular. And he flew so low they ran into a telegraph pole. Gotcha. And they had to camp rough. They finally got rescued and were going to fly them out. And the plane crashed on takeoff, set on fire, and his hair set on fire. He suffered a punctured lung, I think, broken ribs, and it really almost, I think that was beginning of the descent for his health. So it was actually quite, if you're a Hemingway fan like me, it was quite a poignant place to visit. And also, it was a very, very simple guest house in a way in Masindi. It's called the Masindi Hotel, but it had this wonderful terrace where you can sit out kind of reading a book. And it had this feeling of that glamour of that era. I think it was built in the 1930s. And obviously a glamour that you have to see in a slightly nuanced way with the history around it. But there is something about these old colonial buildings that exude this aura of the glamour, I guess, of those times, which I enjoyed visiting, actually. We sat on the veranda of this hotel where Hemingway was probably licking his wounds. So I was talking to the Masindi educational director about the future of education in Uganda there, the challenges, and it seemed just a nice place to be sitting. I thought it was a wonderful place. You can see the sun go down by there inside the decors, this wonderful dark wood. It's a really nice place that isn't expensive, by the way, where you can go and have a little bit of African glamour, if I can call it that.
And you mentioned expensive. My assumption is expensive to get to, cheap once you're there.
Exactly. That's exactly how it is.
Especially if you're biking around. But
yeah, you can travel around in these. Everything sounds a bit like Matuke, but I think they're called Matuka. The taxis, where there are basically minivans. You see them all over Africa, where they pack you in and they pick you up and drop you off where you want, or pick anyone up wherever they want to be picked up.
We also saw quite a few people who had been in Matukas when we were in a hospital in the orthopedic ward, too. So not the most safest means of transportation statistically, but and probably your biggest actual risk going to someplace like Africa.
That's certainly something that the guidebooks say. And I've been in a minivan in Uganda, in Ghana, that had a tire blowout. And I think perhaps now, as I was saying, I'm getting old and wise. The vibrant ways to travel, perhaps not the safest. There are also 50-seater buses that ply between the main cities. Mm-hmm. Again, very, very reasonable, very cheap to get around. The guest houses, you're sometimes paying about $10. If you stay in a place like the Masindi Hotel, it's more, but it's compared to staying in a simple bed and breakfast in Europe, it's good value. There are high-end places. There's the Para Safari Lodge, where we had a blowout at the end of our trip to celebrate, which was fantastic. I felt a bit guilty being there because we'd been to visit school projects where kids have no shoes. We went through these villages where people really just...
Well, it's just a way to leave as much money in the country as possible. So
they're eating, thinking, wow, these people, they have a tough life. And a few hours later, I was stuffing myself with dal curry. They have although Idi Amin kicked the Asians out of Uganda infamously.
Oh, I did not realize that. Okay.
Yeah, he had this, it was called the Economic Wars, and there was a kind of tension between the Asians in Uganda because they ran all the businesses and were rich, and he announced they all had to leave. 500,000 left for Britain in a matter of weeks. But the Asian, a lot of returned for a start to go and reclaim their family possessions. And anyway, the influence on the food has been left. You can get in Kampala fantastic curries. And on our last blowout night in the Para Safari Lodge, which overlooks the Nile, you can live like a king there, I can tell you, Chris, eating a fantastic food. And that's the other side of Ugandan tourism. You don't actually have to rough it if you don't want. There are wonderful places to stay if you can afford.
Well, it's funny because when I talk to people about that once-in-a-lifetime trip to Africa or whatever, I think many people assume that those are the only places to stay, is the expensive places. Because as they look at safaris, they look at the brochures and everything is $3,000 for a week or something like that. And so I think they'd be a little surprised and not necessarily that a $10 a night hotel is what they're looking for either. But
no, and what I have to say here too is, of course, these places aren't particularly glamorous. You have some showers that trickle out cold water, but you've got it usually, and it's clean, swept. And I have to say this too, because I was so paranoid about getting ill, I was putting on this antibacterial gel on my hands before eating anything. I had been ill in Africa before, and I thought cycling and having stomach problems would be a nightmare. I was totally healthy the whole time, and the places were clean. So not the luxury you get in a hotel in Europe, but clean and practical, and always you get something to eat at the bar, a place to stay. It's really, if you're prepared to put up with different standards of, say, showers, then you can have a totally fine time. You don't have to feel that you have to be Indiana Jones to travel.
We found that, you know, we had a 10-person group, and I went to Tanzania, just one country south of there, and in a 2-week trip, we did have a couple people who were sick for a day. I'm sure it was something they ate. We packed a little Cipro, basically, and they took one dose, slept for a day, and were fine the next day. So,
yeah,
that's not too bad if that happens.
It's interesting you mentioned Tanzania, because one thing that I learned, which I didn't know, is the great feeling of kinship across East Africa, that there is a kind of feeling of it being a region as well as individual countries. And Kenyans that I spoke to feel very at home in a way in Uganda. And apparently that's the same as true of Tanzania. I think there's a different feeling, often in a negative sense too, of nationalities, that people feel that they are East African as well as being Ugandan. And that was nice. Of my small experience of it, I thought there was a great spirit of kinship between the different peoples of the region.
Well, of course, Swahili being common in the area probably helps with that somewhat too.
Although not many people in Uganda do speak Swahili. It's the trade language, isn't it?
Right. No, I think it's much more common in Kenya and Tanzania. In fact, when you started saying words in Swahili, I've sort of forgot that it was at all common in Uganda. But
it was really interesting, because I have to say we had a support car with our bike ride, who took our bags and looked after us. They were wonderful. Everywhere we went, people were fascinated by us in a nice way. Once we stopped to eat some more little bananas by the side of the road, and an entire school, and I mean, Chris, an entire school came out to just stand and look at us, all in their purple uniforms. Kids at the side of this small road. And then they were quite shy when we tried to talk to them. They were kind of like, we're going to back away. What are these white people with, you know, strange shaped noses and strange shaped clothes on? We're wearing lycra. You've got to imagine it. And at one point they were crowded so close around that the guy driving started talking to them in Swahili. And he said, what did you say? You know, do they understand that? And he said, no, they don't understand. But it's the tone of voice, isn't it? So I guess it's not quite as widespread. There are lots of different languages in Uganda, I think. I didn't actually get to learn any of them, sadly. As I say, I was there for a short time. One thing, having been in West Africa, I always liked the way people speak there, but I was totally blown away by the accent in East Africa. It's this wonderful, soft way of speaking. I found it a really poetic way of speaking English. I'm not sure if that was your experience in East Africa, but it's one of the things I remember. Of course, as a radio journalist, just hearing people explain things in East African accents was wonderful. It's a soft,
quite noticeably soft, especially compared to who they consider really loud and somewhat obnoxious, which is Americans. So, which is true.
It sounds, of course, we're coming from an era of a great history of violence, but the way they speak has this wonderful soft gentleness about it. You feel that conflicts are sort of avoided in the way people talk with each other. And I just enjoy just interviewing people because of the way they express themselves, and the way that the sentences dipped up and down in this kind of sing-song way. It was totally seductive. I don't know. I know it's a very superficial thing to notice about a country, but I found that people speak was so musical that I was delighted by it.
Interesting. When did you feel closest to home, most familiar, and then when did you feel furthest from home? This is not England. This is not even Austria.
I can tell you about obviously, was when I was sitting there with a bunch of Ugandans watching my first Premier League football. United against Chelsea, and everyone was on my side, and this was wonderful. When I felt the furthest from home, well, two things. One, in a very good way. We stayed in one quite rural guest house in a very small town called Kayunga, and someone said, oh, there's a music concert going on tonight here, and we thought, well, we're not going to get any sleep, so let's go. And actually, there was a big security presence outside. It was in the grounds of this guest house, but there were men with machine guns checking the guests, and I thought, well, this is going to be a bit dodgy. And I went in, and they had white seats with matriarchs sitting there and children sitting beside them. So I'm not sure what the security was about. But a fantastic African artist. One was playing almost Congolese swinging soulful music. And then this crazy rapper came on, jumping around like a fly. He was doing splits in the air and gyrating his crotch. As I say, these seated matriarchs in a form of rap that's, a very African style of rap, very upbeat. I've no idea what he was singing about, but it was very joyful. And I hadn't been to an African music concert in 10 years. And that's when I felt, wow, this is something you do not get where I'm from. I felt, I guess, worryingly away from home was we stayed in the campsite in Murchison Falls National Park. And I told you I'm scared of hippos. We were drinking a beer at the bar, and then the hippo was wandering through the campsite. And I knew it was getting dark, and I had to somehow find my way back to where I was sleeping. Thinking, I don't want to be the headline boy from Austria eaten by hippo in Uganda. I'm totally terrified by them. It's like a phobia. Like,
well, they wouldn't eat you. They are herbivores, but they might kill you. They are dangerous. I think more so if you'd encounter them in the river, is my understanding.
Because I was talking to Milton, the guide on the river, about hippos, trying to get over my phobia. And he was telling me that that's why they come on land to, for example, mow the grass by campsites, because they eat grass at night. Right. That's what they do. Mm-hmm. But when you look into those jaws, which are...
it's not wide, a lot of teeth there, though.
Very big, long, white, yellow ones. And I'm not getting in their way. They're beautiful animals. When they when they make those noises, it sounds like a cow is trying to do an impression of a pig, I always think. They're wonderful, but I like them from a distance. And when I knew I had to kind of skirt through in the dark to find my place to stay, I was thinking, this is a long way from safe old Austria. I felt the furthest from home, but in a nice way, in a kind of an exotic way.
Well, I think they're supposed to sound like a horse. That's at least where the name comes from. The name comes from water horse.
In Austrian, it's in German, I should say. It's Nilpferd, which means Nile horse. So,
interesting. Yeah. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Uganda.
I think I've already mentioned it. I think it was when we were invited to a wedding and we found ourselves wearing, having confetti thrown over our heads. And I thought, can you imagine in Britain, in the United States, in Austria, a bunch of African cyclists going through a suburbia and someone saying, hey, come and join us at our wedding. It takes a moment to think about what that means in terms of open-mindedness, a welcoming spirit, and just sense of fun, because they thought it was hilarious we were at their wedding. But they were laughing because we were there and just enjoying our presence. So we didn't feel bad because we were added to the entertainment, it is wonderful. And the sense of fun, I felt it when I was as a volunteer journalist in Ghana. Uganda's a very different place, but that was one thing that was the same. This sense of spontaneity, sense of here come some people from a different place. Let's have fun with them. That was what I will take away.
You're standing in the most beautiful spot that you saw in Uganda. Where are you standing and what are you looking at?
Okay, well, I'm standing at the Murchison Falls National Park forest, and the Nile is just below in it. It's glistening in the sunlight, and I can see the elephants in the distance there washing themselves at the side of the river. I'm a bit bothered still by the flies, but I'm thinking, to get to a place like this, you've got to put up with a few pesky buzzers. Yeah, I think that was the most standout, beautiful place that it is like nowhere I've visited. And the other side of the river with this totally different landscape, savanna and giraffes, long yellow golden grassland, and the sort of thing you think that only Sir David Attenborough visits in his nature programs, and that I perhaps won't see. And I did see it, and because it was a short trip, I kept saying, this doesn't seem real enough. I can't realize that we're really here. We've seen it too much on TV to believe it actually exists in real life.
Excellent. Before we close with our final two questions, do you have anything else that people should know before they hop on a plane and hop on a bike and visit Uganda?
No, I think the essential information you can get from the guidebooks in terms of injections you must get. No, I would say go there with an open mind and be ready to meet people, because they are the joy of Uganda. Of course, there are fantastic animals like rhinos and hippos and giraffes, but just get to talk to the local people there. And I find it really enriching. And of course, if you do it in the right way, it's a good thing too, because as I say, when I went to this place where I felt might have been a bit tainted by oil money, and this is just a theory, as I say, but as soon as you get rich Westerners flying through villages in 4x4s, then that's when you get skewed perceptions. And I think, although it might seem a bit silly cycling through a rural community in Lycra, if you stop and show people that you're interested in them and you like them, I think that's also, to an extent, helps build good relationships in a way that those guys from Europe might be a bit weird, but they seem all right.
They dress funny, but finish this sentence for me. You really know you're in Uganda when what?
When wherever you go, apple-cheeked little children run up to you, jump up and down and shout, Matsungo, Matsungo, Matsungo. White-teethed, wide smiles and just this joy in the eyes. And you just think, wow, all of these children are fantastic.
And if you had to summarize Uganda in three words, what three words would you use?
Friendly.
Mm-hmm.
I say vibrant because I've said it far too often. This friendly, diverse, and joyful.
Excellent. Well, one thing I have to say is that you're well-spoken in audio. Have you thought about a career in radio? The other is there someplace that people can read more about your travels?
Yes, there is actually. I've even written a book. So it's called A Summer in West Africa. It's actually a story of my volunteering in Ghana. And it might be fun because people might recognize themselves when you go out to, as a young person, to an African country. And this mix of naivety and pomposity, because you really think you're down with the locals, and misadventures, but kind of learning a lot about the culture in West Africa and about the people and also about yourself, because however hard I tried to be one of the locals, I was working alongside Ghanaian journalists. Usually it went wrong, but I left, as with Uganda, and that's why I went back, with this great admiration for the people who were inventive and able to really make a lot of success out of difficult circumstances. And that was the beginning of what's been a lifelong love affair, I guess, with Africa. So you can, if you read that, I'll be very happy.
Christian, thanks so much for coming on The Amateur Traveler and sharing with us your love affair of Africa and especially for Uganda.
It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
I do have news of the community this week, but we're going to save it till next week. This show is getting long enough, and I'm just heading out the door to teach an all-day class on multimedia blogging, including podcasting. So I want to get this podcast done before that. If you have any feedback, feel free to send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com or leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. The link to the show notes will be in the lyrics for this particular episode. You can join us on Facebook, facebook.com/amateurtraveler, or follow me on Twitter, @ChrisTuax. And as always, thanks so much for listening.